8. The way up the 1,000 steps had been wearisome, but intensely happy both in anticipation and in the present. The way down was more wearisome by far, partly because an exceedingly heavy warm rain fell from the moment he crossed the crater's rim, so thick that he couldn't see 50 yards ahead, and so violent that the drops splashed high, wetting him to the middle. It also obscured the worn, uneven steps, which made the descent anxious, tense, full of care. But beneath all the physical tension, there was an even greater happiness than before, that of a fulfilment that had gone beyond any anticipation, and of something not far from the beatific vision. It glowed within, under the sodden straw cloak the monks had given him, and it was glowing still when he staggered down the last steps and onto the level sward of the durian grove. The rain stopped as suddenly as it had begun, and the forest was filled with the sound of running water. He looked expectantly round, but seeing no one, he felt in his bosom, the only moderately dry place about him, for the repeating watch that hung there by a string. It was as he inclined his head to hear its tiny bell state that he was an hour and a half behind his time, that he noticed the horses' rumps glistening under the lee of the Hindu tower. Beyond them, a pyramid of tall palm fronds inverted to throw off the wet, and inside it, Seymour, with two Malays smoking tobacco. "Lord, sir," cried Seymour, who had started up with a look of grave concern at his appearance. "I beg your pardon. I thought you was an orangutan."
"Do I look like an orangutan, Mr. Seymour?"
asked Stephen. "To tell you the truth, sir, I believe you do."
"Perhaps it's the effect of my straw cloak," said Stephen, looking at his arm.
"Yet it was a fine, stiff, rain-shedding garment to begin with. I hope I've not kept you waiting." "Lord, no, sir," said Seymour. "I think you're exact to the minute or close on. We came rather early, as the captain said."
"How is Mr. Aubrey?"
"When last I saw him, sir, he was in fine form. He ran up to the main jack the other day. Think of that, sir, at his age. But now he's gone off with the master to survey the coast. Should you like something to eat, sir? I've brought you a chicken. It was Mr. Elliot that shot it."
"I should like a chicken of all things," said Stephen. "A handful of rice was my breakfast at dawn."
He greeted the Malays, a glum, wet, cross-looking pair, very unlike the Dyaks. They bowed and answered politely, but said there was no time to be lost. The waters were out in the forest and in the plain. They must hurry if they were ever to get back at all. "Well, I shall eat my chicken, however," said Stephen, sitting down. "How did Mr. Elliot come to shoot it? This bird is far too big for a jungle fowl." "Very true, sir, but he thought it was a jungle fowl. He thought all these," pointing to the stripped carcasses on the floor, "were jungle fowl, and he blazed away until the woman of the house came and threw a bucket of water over him and his gun. There was a great hullabaloo, and he had to pay. But that was nothing to the hullabaloo in the town the next day, sir. People running about and screeching and letting off muskets like a revolution."
"Come, Tuan," said the older, sourer, wetter Malay. "The horses are saddled. We must go."
Seymour's kindly chicken had been carried in a tarpaulin bag for hours through a tropical rainforest, and it tasted so very like physic that Stephen abandoned it without much reluctance and stumped out onto the sodden grass. "Let me give you a leg up, sir," said Seymour. And Stephen, rising into the saddle under his impulsion, realised that for Seymour he too was an aged man. Several other marks of solicitude fell into line. He had been led across a busy street in Batavia. His boots had been pulled off at Buitenzorg. And a puzzling half-heard recommendation that Clark should take care of the ancient now lost its mystery. Did a very old, weather-beaten, sun-bleached wig make its wearer look, if not decrepit, then at least past mark of mouth?
"Tell me about your revolution," he began.
But before Seymour could reply, they'd entered the homeward track from the durian grove, and the horses were slithering down what was now a muddy stream in single file. Before the rain began again, Stephen did manage, in odd bursts, to extract what little information Seymour had to give. Facts he had none, but he did convey an atmosphere of crisis. People said that there was an armed rising, that the vizier had been dragged off to prison loaded with chains, that the sultan was on his way back. At another halt, and in a completely different context, Seymour also said that the French had heaved down their ship. They were careening her and, raising his voice over the roar of the hurtling rain, they'd chosen a damned bad moment for doing so, the lubbers. It was a damn bad moment for travelling, too. The following hours, though not very great in number, seemed almost infinite in extent. The forest leeches had never been so active, agile, enterprising. And when at last the troop reached the flooded plain, creeping in mud to their knees and often losing the way in the featureless landscape, the horse leeches were worse by far. During those halts, when it was possible to converse, Stephen tried to learn what was happening from the Malays, but they told him little. They may not have known. They may have been afraid. They certainly held him responsible for the perfectly horrible time they were having, and presently he saw that it was useless to insist. When at last they reached it, the town was more informative. Prabang had been spared all but the fringe of the downpour, and although the river was tearing along mud-coloured, covered with tree trunks and branches, full from bank to bank, the streets themselves were now no more than damp. And even at this time of night, they would ordinarily have been full of people. There was no one. Even Maturin's Javanese place was shut up and blind. The only light to be seen was a general orange glow over the palace roofs, and the only sound, apart from the voice of the river, was a confused hubbub behind the palace walls. The poor, foundered horses were led back to their stable. The Malays paid and rewarded. Stephen, aware that the young, however kind and solicitous, had in fact less stamina than the old, took Seymour back to the ship, told Macmillan to remove every single leech before letting him lie down. The boy was sleeping as he stood, and then walked off to Van Buren's house. "How glad I am you are a night bird," he said, sitting down heavily. "I should have been in a sad way, else my brothel is shut." "You must take off your clothes," said Van Buren, looking at him with close attention. "And when we've rid you of all your parasites, you must rub yourself with a towel and put on a dressing gown. Then, with an omelette in a pot of coffee, you'll feel more nearly human." "Dear colleague," said Stephen 6 cups later, "never did you make a better prognosis, but I'm interrupting your work." "Not at all. I'm only arranging the skins you were so very kind as to send me. Many thanks indeed. There is a nectarineer I'd never seen, and what I take to be a new subspecies of Gracculus. Tell me, how did your journey go?" "Kumai was nearer paradise than anything I am likely to see again in this life or the next. I cannot bless my fate enough for having been allowed it. I communed with the orangutans. They held me by the hand. I saw the tarsier, immeasurable wealth. But allow me to tell you at another time and at immeasurable length. First, pray, let me know what is afoot." "Before I do so," said Van Buren, holding up one hand, "tell me whether you have brought the tarsier for us to dissect." Stephen shook his head, thinking of the simple-minded little creature that had gazed at him with its huge noctambulance eyes, sitting just the other side of a Nanda's lamp. "I promised not to kill anything." "And indeed, you know," he said, "a man would need a heart of brass to kill a tarsier." "Where primates are concerned, I have a heart of brass," said Van Buren, "and the tarsier is the strangest of them all. But to return," he went on, looking at Stephen with his head cocked on one side, "do you really wish me to tell you what's afoot?" "Certainly I do." "Well," still looking at him quizzically,
Half Sir and her family took what I was going to call your advice, but which I find I must call the advice arising from some outside source. And at the third attempt, their people seized Abdul in bed with Ledward and Ray. The Europeans pleaded the Sultan's safe conduct, and the vizier let them go. But Abdul was hurried off, and messengers were sent to the Sultan. Some of Abdul's friends made a commotion, but the vizier's men and the remaining Dayak guard soon put them down, and now those who ran away are being searched for. That's why the houses are all shut up.
I see, I see.
A long pause. How do you think it'll end?
I don't know.
Abdul's pretty face may save his skin, it may not.
I just don't know.
By the way, I should have told you before, your Pondicherry clerk,
Le Sir,
was murdered. Pray tell Mr. Fox to take great care. He's likely to be here in the morning, well before the Sultan and his train. He would be well advised to go aboard the ship. So might you. Assassins are 10 a penny in Prabang, and poison is by no means rare.
They might, too.
I'll find you a pair of pistols and send Latif and the watchman with you. The boat put off. The boat pulled back. Stephen, limp with fatigue, was hauled up the side. Richardson led him to his cot, and before he sank into something not far removed from a coma, he heard a voice saying, "The knocking shop's closed and the doctor's come out of bed," followed by a cackle of good-natured laughter. 8 bells in the morning watch pierced through the very deep fog of sleep, and Stephen raised his head, aware of an urgency, though not of its nature. Some moments later, the pattern fell into shape, and he called aloud for Ahmed. After the first reviving cup, he said, "Ahmed, I must shave my face and put on my good black coat." At 1 bell in the forenoon watch, he stepped onto the quarterdeck, smooth and decently dressed, stared at the washed, innocent sky, and said, "My dear Mr. Fielding, good morning to you. Please, may I have a boat to take me ashore with a couple of marines as a guard? I'm going to see Mr. Fox, and the town is somewhat disturbed." Fox had arrived an hour before. He was in a state of intense but contained excitement, and his greeting, though friendly and even familiar, was utterly detached. "One of my informants has been murdered," said Stephen, "and as I dare say you know already, Ledward and Ray are still at large. There is the possibility not only of open murder, but also of poison secretly administered. A most reliable source tells me that you should take very great care."
"Thank you for the warning. I did indeed know that they were at large. I'd scarcely reached the house before a note came from Ray, offering to bear witness against Ledward in return for protection and removal to any other country or island whatsoever. Here it is."
"He must think you bear Ledward very great ill will," said Stephen, having looked at the note. Fox grinned and said,
I hope to have him put to the same death as Abdul. The only thing I'm afraid of is the Sultan's notion of honour. He gave them his safe conduct, and he's so very touchy about these matters that even the vizier dared not arrest them. They'd be sure they may have been taken up secretly in case the Sultan should change his mind. They've not been seen in the French compound. Yet, whether or no, I think we may say the treaty is in the bag, to use a low expression.
"Let us not say anything of the sort," said Stephen. "My very best source tells me that it is the toss of a coin whether Abdul doesn't turn the scale with his pretty face and his gazelle-like eyes."
"Does he go so far? Does he indeed?"
cried Fox, disconcerted. He searched Stephen's face.
"I must go."
He rang the bell and ordered a guard.
"I have an appointment with the vizier. The Sultan comes back late this afternoon. There's to be a full council meeting, and there'll be a decision tonight. Your balcony at your lodging at the town looks over the palace courtyards. May I call on you this evening? I've not heard a word about your journey to Kumar. You went, of course." "I beg your pardon for appearing like this,"
said the envoy, who was wearing the marine officer's uniform and blue spectacles. "But I thought a very sensible precaution, sir," said Stephen. "Nothing hides a man better than a red coat. Pray come in and sit on the balcony. There is a modest collation laid out. The sea slugs are a speciality of the house. So, alas, is the lukewarm Macau wine, but we can always call for tea or coffee. And quite soon, shortly after sunset, you will see a blazing great star rise over there by the Mosque of Omar. Jack Aubrey tells me it is Jupiter. And if he were here with his telescope, he would show you the four little moons." "I beg your pardon," said Stephen's sleeping partner, opening the door and looking at Fox with intense curiosity. "I forgot my drawers." "Before coming here," said Stephen as they settled on the balcony overlooking the busiest street, the open space in front of the Rasool Mosque, and the wall and the outer courtyards of the palace beyond, "I had, like everybody else, read about Malays running amok, or amok, as I believe one should say, but never did I expect to see two of them doing so at once. My first sight of the phenomenon at that. One came down this very street not an hour ago, cleaving his way in the midst of a frantic clamour, slashing right and left, a train of blood behind and a herd of people running away in front, until he was brought down and killed by a Dayak with a spear. Then, while the crowd was standing round the body, talking and laughing and pushing their krisses into it, another maniac came down that little side street, screaming shrill and high, and they scattered again. He ran off out of sight right-handed, having wounded two men as he passed, and what happened to him I cannot tell. But 5 minutes later, people were walking about, talking, buying and selling, and fanning themselves as though nothing had happened. It's a strangely cruel and bloody country at times," said Fox, "or perhaps indifferent is the better word." They ate in silence, wandering among the array of dishes. The shadows lengthened. Fox was searching in a bowl of prawns when he raised his head and stood motionless. "That must be the Sultan arriving," he said. The drums and trumpets grew louder, then suddenly louder by far as the procession turned the corner and filed in through the outer palace gate. More trumpets within, and the sound of shouting wafted over on the seaward breeze so that it was almost at hand. "Before the light fades, I should like to show you the drawings I made of Kumai," said Stephen. "They're inept. They suffered much from the rain, particularly the outer leaves, but they may give you some notion of what I saw." "Oh, please do," cried Fox, his whole attitude changing. "I long to see what you brought down." "This is my attempt at the great figure which dominates the temple. The stone is a smooth, light-grey, fine-grained volcanic rock. The drawing gives no sense of its majestic serenity, nor any of that feeling of far greater size than its actual 12 feet, which is so strong when you stand before it. Nor can you easily see that the raised right hand has its palm facing outwards." "Oh, I can make out the hand very well. A capital drawing, Maturin. I'm so grateful to you. This is the Buddha in the Abhaya Mudra attitude, signifying fear not, all is well. Oh, such an omen! As far as I know, no other has ever been recorded in these parts. Here are my paced-out plans, and this is what I call the narthex, where I slept. These are the particular carvings of a sculptured frieze where the narthex roof joins the main body. The marks show where the beams have impinged upon the frieze, obscuring it in places. Obviously, the carvings are earlier than the roof." "Oh, yes," said Fox, studying the pages with great attention. "These are very early indeed. Perhaps earlier than anything I've ever seen in Malay country. Lord, what a discovery!" While there was still day enough, he took Stephen over them again and again. And then he said, "It'd be a pity to call for a lamp. I have all the plans and drawings clear in my head, and I could follow you piece by piece if you'd be so very kind as to describe everything you saw."
"That would take us well into next year, but I'll try to give some general impression,"
When I begin with the nectarinias, which take the place of hummingbirds here, do nectarinias interest you? Only moderately. Orangutans, then. To tell you the truth, Maturin, there are already so many orangutans among my acquaintance that I wouldn't cross the street to see another. Well, well, perhaps I'd better start with the Hindu temple and confine myself to holy things and their surroundings. This he did. And as his tail rose up the thousand steps shrine by shrine, so the sun sank to the western sea. And by the time he was describing his first sight of the temple, its former immensity and the disposition of its parts, Jupiter had appeared. Stephen reached the narthex, the opening of the temple door, the sunlight showing him the figure within, and Fox said, "Oh, I quite agree. I have had a greater sense of holiness, sanctity, detachment, unworldliness, in the severer Buddhist temples of the ancient rite than in any but the most austere Christian monasteries." Fox was making a long parenthetical remark about his travels on the border of Tibet and Ceylon when there was a clash of discordant drums and cymbals from the palace, a volley of musket fire, the sound of trumpets, and of a great long roaring horn. This was followed by a more regular beating of drums, and the innermost courtyard was lit with great lanterns by the score. Then came the wavering orange glare of a fire that rose and rose, so that sometimes its flames showed high above the outer wall. Its smoke drifted straight over them as they sat there silent on the balcony. The hoarse, roaring horn again, and the firelight turned blood red as a powder was thrown on the blaze. "Someone's going to catch it," said Fox, "and I hope to God it's Ledward. I hope to God the sack is tying round his neck this moment." Now there was shouting from the palace, loud shouting and laughter, perhaps some muffled screams. The fire leapt higher still, flame-coloured once more. The lights increased, and the shouting, it was very like the sound of a rising or a hysterical mob. How long it went on, there was no telling. Once or twice Stephen saw great bats pass between him and the glare, and all the time Fox stood gripping the rail, dead still, hardly breathing. At length the mob noise diminished. The fire died down so that its flames could no longer be seen. The drums fell silent, and the lanterns moved off, leaving no more than a ruddy glow behind the walls. "What happened? What happened?" cried Fox. "What happened exactly? I've no one inside the palace. I cannot make my visit until his fasting for air is over. I cannot even see the council straight away. To act on mere gossip or an inaccurate account would be disastrous, yet I must act. Can you help me, Maturin?"
"I know a person who will have the details within the hour," said Stephen coldly. "I shall call on him tomorrow morning."
"Couldn't you go now?"
"No, sir."
Stephen had, in fact, no need to call on Van Buren. They met in the Buffalo Market. For a while they talked about the animals, wild relations, the banteng and the gaur, either of which might have breathed upon Stephen by night at Kumai, creatures of enormous size. And then Stephen said, "My colleague is importunate to know what happened last night. Did Abdul's pretty face and gazelle-like eyes save him?" By the time Hafsa had finished, he had no pretty face and no gazelle-like eyes either. "No. The sack was tied over his head and he was beaten round and round the fire until the pepper and the beating killed him." "Ledward and Ray?" "Untouched. Some people thought they were going to be seized, immunity or no, but I believe the Sultan had a sickening of it all. Abdul's body was given to his family for burial rather than being thrown into the street. And they are only forbidden the court." It had always appeared to Jack Aubrey, ever since he was a little boy, that one of the purest joys in the world was sailing a small, well-conceived, weatherly boat. The purest form of sailing, too, with the sheet alive in one's hand, the tiller quivering under the crook of one's knee,
and the boat's instant response to the movement of either and to the roll and the breeze. A more stirring, obvious joy, of course, in a moderate gale and a lively sea. But there was also a subtle delight in gliding over smooth water, coaxing every ounce of thrust from what light air there was, an infinitely varied joy. Yet since he'd left the midshipman's berth, he'd done very little sailing in this sense, and almost none for pure pleasure. And as a post-captain, usually wafted to and fro in the glory of his barge, he could scarcely remember half a dozen occasions. Apart from anything else, the life of a captain, even with such a conscientious, intelligent first lieutenant as Fielding, was an uncommonly busy one, at least as Jack Aubrey led it. He was fond of the Diane, that honest, stout-hearted, though unexciting ship, but he was thoroughly enjoying his holiday from her. The survey of the coast of Pulau Prabang with Mr. Warren, an able hydrographer, was a lively pleasure in itself. But the great charm of these days was the sailing, as varied as could be wished, the swimming, the fishing, and the hauling up on a lonely strand at sunset to eat their catch, grilled on driftwood embers, and to sleep in tents or in hammocks slung between two palms. They'd sailed east, following the curve of the island, the almost round island, to its northernmost point, passing several villages on the way, including Amberlan, the little port to which the French frigate Cornélie and her over-enterprising crew had been exiled. Now they were on their way back, checking their recorded bearings and soundings, and carrying on with Humboldt's programme of measuring temperatures at various depths, salinity, atmospheric pressure and the like. But none of this was very arduous, and at present Jack was directing the Diane's smaller cutter at the narrow pass between the cape right ahead and a small island just beyond it. He was sailing as close to the brisk west-south-westerly breeze as he could. The good clinker-built boat made little leeway, and he thought he could run through the gap on the present tack. Bondon, who though by right captain's coxswain hadn't had his hand on the tiller since the boat left Prabang, was sure he could. Warren, the master, who was unable to swim, thought he possibly could, but wished he wouldn't attempt it. Yusuf, who had been brought along for the language, and because he knew the difference between right and wrong, at least where fish and fruit were concerned, was convinced that it was impossible, but being a Muslim, he took it in good part, since what was written, and there was no arguing with fate, and in any case he was a sea Malay, as much at home in the water as out of it. There should have been a fifth opinion, that of Bamfield Elliot. Jack had meant to bring him, because although young Elliot was no seaman and never would be, Jack liked him. As the Diane's commander, he had had to address harsh words to her second lieutenant oftener than was either usual or pleasant, and he'd hoped that this break would bring back kinder relations. It was not that Elliot had grown dogged, sullen or resentful. It was rather that his mind seemed oppressed by a sense of guilt and inadequacy, and by the little esteem in which he was held aboard the Diane. But the day before they set out, when Fielding was having the frigate's yards re-blacked, a hand busy high aloft dropped his bucket. It might perfectly well have fallen safely, there being very few people on deck. 100 to 1 it would have done no more harm than a black stain to be scrubbed out by the afterguard. But, in fact, it struck Elliot on his wounded shoulder, he being unlucky as well as inept. The headland, the gap, and the island were coming closer. Much closer. Jack, bending and peering forward, saw that the high land was deflecting the breeze so that it would head him in mid-passage. There was a slight cross-ruffle on the ebbing tide. His mind at once began computing speed, inertia, distance, most desirable course, and presented him with the answer in something less than a second, 100 yards short of the rock. A few moments more and he bore up, gathered away, and with the greater impetus shot through the gap right in the wind's eye, his mainsail shivering, rounded the cape and ran down its farther side. The saving of 5 insignificant minutes was no very great triumph. Indeed, the caper had a faint, very faint air of showing away. But it was pleasant to feel the old skills unimpaired. The coast in this part of Pulau Prabang was much indented, and the fjord they were now entering had a companion beyond it. These deep, narrow bays were separated by Cape Bugis, and in his chart Jack called this one East Bugis Inlet and the next West Bugis Inlet, although in the Dian it was called Frenchman's Creek, since Ambalan, with the Connelly in its harbour, lay on the eastern shore. The road from a number of fishing villages and little towns to Prabang followed the coast wherever it could, and it crossed the bottom of both these inlets. Jack's idea was to land far down in the first, walk along the shore to the road and so round to the western side of the next, from which he could view the Connelly over the water. In spite of all his swimming, he felt in need of a walk, and he was by no means disinclined to see how the French were coming along. He knew they were careening their ship, a perilous business on a coast with such considerable tides, and he wanted to see their progress, if only from a professional point of view. On its outward voyage, the boat had crossed the mouth of West Bugis Inlet, but Jack hadn't sailed down it, though the wind was fair. He wished to avoid any sort of indiscretion that might have a bad effect on Fox's dealings with the Sultan. But it seemed to him that his behaviour couldn't be thought improper if, in the course of a walk, he looked at the Connelly from the other side of the bay, particularly as French officers had often brought telescopes to peer at the Dian from Prabang. Then, having gazed his fill and taken a fresh set of bearings, he would walk on, crossing the next promontory to the farther strand, where, touching wood, he would find the boat hauled up and smoke rising from the evening fire. While the very word supper was sounding in his head, both Yusuf and Bondon caught a fish, a fine silvery fish, a 2 or 3 pounder with crimson eyes and crimson fins. "Padang fish, Tuan," cried Yusuf. "Good, good, very good fish." "So much the better," said Jack, and he let fly the sheet, bringing the cutter gently to the shore. He stepped neatly out, his shoes and his ditty bag slung round his neck, shoved the boat off, called out, "This evening, then, in Parrot Bay," and sat down on the warm sand to dry his feet. Warren replied cheerfully, but Bondon, though back in his rightful place in the stern sheets, shook his head with a despondent look. He would have liked the captain to take at least a hanger and a brace of pistols, if not a musket and a couple of well-armed hands as well. The sand here was pinkish-white, quite unlike the volcanic black of Prabang itself, and delightfully firm. Jack, dry foot and shod, stretched out at a fine pace, his eyes half closed against the glare, and presently he reached the bottom of the bay and, above high water mark, the road. 5 minutes after striking into it, he was in the grateful shade of sago palms. They stood deep on either side almost the whole way to the village, and they were completely uninhabited. No people, no animals, scarcely a bird, except for myriads of insects, which he could rarely see and never identify, but which kept up a continual din so all-pervading that after a few minutes he was unaware of it, except on those rare occasions when it suddenly stopped entirely. The sago palms were not very beautiful, being thick and short, while their dull green crowns were rather dusty, and presently he found their company and the loneliness oppressive. It was a relief to walk out of the shade at last and into the rice paddies outside the village at the bottom of West Bugis Inlet. People were working in them, and some looked up as he went by, but without any particular interest, far less astonishment. Much the same applied to the village itself, sparsely inhabited at this time of day, and from here the reason for their indifference was evident, since the whole long bay was now open before him, with Ambalan on the eastern side, its harbour quite crowded, and 2 Chinese junks lying just offshore. Of course these people were used to strangers. Beyond the village, the road mounted to the crest of the long, rocky headland that formed the inlet's other arm.
and at the top of the hill Jack, now in a fine state of sweat, turned off right-handed to walk out to a point where he would be opposite the little port. There was a path, he found, winding among the boulders and the low, wind-stunted vegetation, and soon he saw why. Dotted along the edge of the sea below him, there were great fallen rocks, by the score well out from the strand, and on many of them stood fishermen with long bamboos casting beyond the moderate surf of the tide now on the make. And each group of rocks had a corresponding side path leading down to it. When he'd travelled something like a mile, he took one of these and dropped down the slope, going rather more than halfway, to the clearly defined division between the zone where the wind was strong enough and steady enough to keep the trees and bushes short, and the zone in the lee of the farther cape where everything grew in his usual wild profusion, trees, rattans, screw pines, and all along the shore itself, coconut palms soaring up in a thousand graceful attitudes. A few paces from where he stopped, there was a little platform with a spring coming out of the cliff face, a dense growth of soft fern, and an astonishing display of orchids growing on the rock, the deep moss, the trees and bushes, orchids of every size, shape and colour. "Lord, I wish Stephen was here," he said, sitting on a convenient mound and taking a small telescope and an azimuth compass from his ditty bag. He said it again some time later, when a large black-and-white bird laboured across the field of his glass carrying a heavy fish in its talons. The glass was only a pocket telescope of no great power, but with the sun shining full on the opposite shore and the air as clear as air could be, he had had a brilliant view of the Cornélie. She had indeed been heaved down on a bank a little north of the town, her copper blazed in the sun, heaved down on her larboard side to a number of uncommon great trees, one of which, or perhaps the creeper that enveloped it, a mass of crimson flowers from top to bottom. "Oh, if only my roses would do that," cried his mind in a parenthesis, running back to the mildewed, aphis-ridden, much-loved shrubs of Ashgrove Cottage. But something was wrong. Something was amiss. There were all the frigate's belongings in neat tarpaulin heaps. There were her guns, intelligently placed to deal with any attack from land or sea. There were her people's tents. But where were the people themselves? A few were creeping about on her copper. A few were busy on a staging against a place where the sheathing had been removed far down under her starboard bow. But there was none of the feverish activity usual on such occasions, with all hands kept hard at it, calls piping, starters flying. Some of them could even be seen playing boule in a smooth, bare place under the coconut palms, watched by scores of their shipmates. The others were presumably sleeping in the shade. While Jack was considering this, he heard the rattle of stones on the path above, and a man with a long rod went down past him. The man called out in Malay as he went by, and Jack replied with an amiable hoot that seemed to satisfy both this fisherman and the one who followed him a little later. But a third man stopped and looked back. Jack saw that although he was as brown as an islander, he was in fact a European, a Frenchman, no doubt. "Captain Aubrey, sir, I believe," he said, smiling. "Yes, sir," said Jack. "You will not remember me, sir, but my name is Dumeny, and I had the honour of being presented to you aboard the Dessay. My uncle, Guillaume Christipanière, commanded her." "Pierrot!" cried Jack, his look of cold reserve changing to open pleasure, as he recognised the little fat midshipman in the long-legged lieutenant. "How very glad I am to see you. Come and sit down. How's your dear uncle?" The dear uncle, in a ship of the line, had captured Jack and his first command, the Sophie, a small brig-rigged sloop, in the Mediterranean as long ago as 1801. He treated his prisoner very handsomely, and they'd become friends. A friendship ripening all the more easily, since Christipanière had English cousins and spoke their language well. His nephew Pierre had spent the piece at school in Bath, and he spoke it even better. They exchanged news of all their former shipmates. Uncle Guillaume was now an admiral, which Jack knew very well, but he was pining at an office desk in Paris, and it was clear that Christy Palliere had followed Jack's career as closely as Jack had followed his. Dumesnil spoke without the least animosity of the dismay and admiration with which they had both received the news of Jack's cutting out the Diane, and went on, "I saw you, of course, at the Sultan's audience, and I've seen you once or twice when I went to look at the poor Diane from Prabang. Of course, it would have been improper to make any gesture, but I did hope you might repay the compliment and come to look at the poor Cornélie. I know some of your people have done so, and from just this very place." "To be sure, it does give a most capital view," said Jack, and there was a significant pause. "Well, sir," said Dumesnil, somewhat embarrassed, "I don't know whether you have ever careened the ship with neither wharf nor hulk." "Never. That's to say, never anything bigger than a sloop. Frightful things might happen. Masts, futtocks." "Yes, sir. And frightful things have happened. I don't mean the slightest criticism of my captain or my shipmates. These things were more in the line of acts of God. But I may say that the ship cannot possibly float before next spring tide. Is very likely not to float until the spring tide after that, and in fact may not float until next year. I tell you this in the hope that you will not attempt cutting her out so that we knock one another on the head to no good purpose. Two line of battleships anchored in the bay and heaving till their cables and their capstans broke couldn't bring her off that infernal bank. You might as well try to cut out the Cordouan light." Dumesnil was no more specific about the frightful things than this, though Jack suspected a hopelessly rung mainmast and several sprung butts at the least. But he did go on to speak of other miseries. The growing hostility of the people of Ambalan. The desertion in two different Philippine vessels of most of the Spanish craftsmen and many foremast hands. And of the frigate's extreme poverty. For weeks they had been living, cabin, gunroom and all, on ancient ship's provisions. Because the money had been mismanaged, and the purser could scarcely afford even the cheapest kind of rice. Credit had always been in indifferent health, and now it was stone dead. No bills on Paris could be attempted to be discounted with the Chinese merchants, even at 90%. "Fortunately," he said, laughing, "there are always these beautiful fish, the padangs. They cruise along in twos and threes just behind the break of the wave when the tide is making, and they take a feather or a shaped piece of bacon rind just like the bass at home. See how they're pulling them out." So they were. Four or five silver flashes along the line of rocks, and it was nearly high water. "Pierre, my dear fellow," said Jack, standing up, "you must run down or you'll lose your tide, and I cannot say worse to a sailor. I'll send you over a little present by one of our Malays, but don't forget to sign the chit so that I know you've had it. There are a lot of goddamn thieves about in these islands, you know." "Oh, sir, that's extremely kind of you, but I cannot take anything from an officer who is technically an enemy. And I never meant to speak of our poverty in any sense of..." "Quel connerie, as your uncle would say. I didn't accept anything from him, did I? Oh, no, by no means, not at all. Only 50 guineas and a whole series of the best dinners I've ever ate. It was the same with the Americans when they took us. Bainbridge of the Constitution fairly loaded me with dollars. Don't be an ass, Piero. Send me word if you can think of a discreet, neutral place where we can meet. Or failing that, let me hear from you the minute peace is signed. Your uncle knows my address. God bless you now." "Well, Stephen," he said, "there you are, back from your godforsaken steps and all alive, I'm happy to see. What luck to find you aboard. Have you abandoned your bawdy house? Have the girls all proved poxed? Or have you turned evangelical?" He sat down, wheezing and wiping his eyes. Stephen waited until he'd had his laugh out. No small matter, since mirth in Jack Aubrey fed upon what he'd laughed at. "What a rattle you are, to be sure," he said at last. "Forgive me, Stephen, but there's something so infinitely comic in the idea of you being a Methody haranguing the girls, handing out tracts. Control yourself, sir. For shame. Well, if I must. Killick! Killick there! Which I'm a-coming, ain't I?
This from a certain distance. And as the cabin door opened,
this is the best I can do, sir. Lemon barley water made of rice and lukewarm at that. But at least the lemon shaddocks, which is close on. Bless you, Killick. The last 3 hours pulling a clock calm as thirsty work. He engulfed a couple of pints, broke into an instant sweat and said, I had such a pleasant encounter yesterday evening. Do you remember when Christy Palliere and the Desay captured us in the year one?
Faith, I shall not easily forget it.
And do you remember his nephew, a little round, fat-faced boy called Piero?
I do not.
No, you were with their surgeon all the time, an ill-looking, yellow-faced... That's to say, a very learned man, I'm sure. Anyhow, there he was, young Piero, all those years ago, and there he was again yesterday. A long, thin lieutenant, much the same in essence, amazing good English, too. We talked for a great while, and he told me not to try cutting out his ship because she couldn't swim until the spring tide after next, if then. They've heaved her down, you know, and what's happened to her futtocks and top timbers. However, since the spring tide after next coincides with our second rendezvous with Surprise, the first is already past, that knocks my idea of waiting for her in the offing on the head. Now, let's suppose Fox will have finished his negotiations even by then, unless he and the Sultan spread more canvas. In any case, it was no more than a general notion.
As for the negotiations, my dear, said Stephen, I believe you may be, how shall I put it, may be mistaken. Laid by the lee. There have been some surprising developments since you sailed away. Shall we take a turn in my little boat? I'll row, you being somewhat worn. Now, he said, resting on his oars, do you remember Ganymede, the Sultan's cup-bearer Abdul? The odious little sod I longed to kick off my quarter-deck? The same. He was the Sultan's minion, not to use a coarser term. But he was unfaithful and he lay with Ledward. They were taken in sodomy. Abdul was put to death, but Ledward and Ray, who had been promised protection, were not. They are only banished from the court and the council and forbidden to take part in any discussions whatsoever. This has reduced Duplessis to helplessness. He cannot speak Malay, and the council, very strict about rank and precedence, will not listen, will not admit a plebeian interpreter. The French mission has very probably failed, but this cannot be known directly, since 1 or 2 days must still pass before Fox can wait on the Sultan. Ledward is, of course, ruined, and Ray with him. But Fox's hatred is by no more lessened, far from it. He was bitterly disappointed that Ledward wasn't put to the same hideous death as Abdul. There is a most inveterate, implacable enmity between them. What is more, it appears to me that Ledward's mind has become deranged. At one time, assassination could have been seen as a perfectly reasonable move in negotiations of this kind and in this part of the world. And at a given point, it was Ledward's only possible chance of success. But now, in the present posture of affairs, it can affect nothing. Yet Ledward has made 2 attempts. A dirty business, Stephen. Very dirty, brother. As dirty as can well be. But unless Duplessis can produce some fresh negotiator and some fresh inducement or obtain yet another postponement... And these are real possibilities, particularly the postponement. The negotiations may not drag on very much longer. And you may be able to keep your rendezvous with the Surprise. He began to paddle back to the Diane in his awkward left-handed way. And after a while he said, out of a deep train of reflection, But, however, I'm glad to hear what you tell me about the French frigate's present state. She'll not move this many a day, said Jack.
It wouldn't surprise me to see orchids growing in the mat on the mainmast where the spar shores meted. Oh, Stephen, that reminds me. Could it have been an osprey I saw carrying a fish slung fore and aft? An eagle-sized bird and quite a large fish. I believe it might have been. I understand the dear birds to be almost universal. Some others are. I was amazed to find a barn owl at Kumai. A true barn owl. A robin wouldn't have surprised me more. They were almost at the frigate's side. I hope you'll sleep aboard tonight and tell me about Kumai, said Jack, and then we might have some music. It's an age since we played so much as a note. Tonight? I believe not. I shall almost certainly be engaged. But tomorrow, with the blessing. Good night, dear colleague, he said, opening the door. I hope I do not interrupt your work. Not at all, said Van Buren. These are only notes for a paper on my usual subject for the Petersburg Academy. I have brought you a cadaver. Wuhan's porters have it in a little cart in the lane. May I tell them to bring it in? And there is another larger, if you would like a second specimen. Oh, by all means, how very kind, how truly thoughtful, my dear Maturin. I'll clear the long table. Wuhan's porters, though powerful, were adroit, exact in their movements. They put down their white-covered burden without disarranging so much as a fold. Pray wait by the cart a few moments, said Stephen. They padded out of the room, eyes cast down, their hands clasped before them, and Van Buren drew back the cloth. This is a European, he said. Yes, said Stephen, trying the edge of a scalpel. An English renegado. I was acquainted with him in London, a Mr. Ray. An English spleen at last. An English spleen, the most famous of them all. And as fresh a cadaver as ever I've had the pleasure of opening. I'm infinitely obliged to you, colleague. Death was caused by this bullet wound, I see. A rifle bullet, how curious. Just so. That was also the case with his companion, the heavier one whom you met once or twice. And the wound was equally recent. Perhaps they've been fighting. Will I send for him? Van Buren looked attentively into Stephen's face, and after a moment he said, Have you arranged this with the vizier, Maturin? I have, too. He said that the court was in no way concerned, that the protection had been publicly and specifically withdrawn and notified to Duplessis, and that we might do whatever we pleased. But he was sure that we would be discreet, that there would be no recognisable remains. Then I'm perfectly satisfied. Oh, what a blessed relief. Let's by all means send for the other, and in the meantime, shall we start at the head? They worked steadily, with a cool, objective concentration. Each had a clear understanding of the matter in hand, the relevant organs, those that might be useful for later comparison and those that might be discarded, and words were rarely necessary. Stephen had been present at many such dissections. He had carried out some hundreds himself, comparative anatomy being one of his chief concerns, but never had he seen such skill, such delicacy in removing the finer processes, such dexterity, boldness, and economy of effort in removing superfluous materials, such speed. And with this example he worked faster and more neatly than he had ever done before. He had little sense of the passage of time, yet even so, when the long table was cleared at last and two fine, fresh, gleaming jars had been placed on Van Buren's shelf of spleens preserved in spirits, when a certain number of organs, as impersonal as the wares in a butcher's shop, had been laid in brine for future use, and when the wholly unrecognisable remains had been shut away in zinc-lined wooden chests, he was surprised to find that it was still night. They took off their long aprons, washed their instruments and their hands,
and went to sit outside in the light of a gibbous moon.
"What a charming breeze," said Stephen. "It must have been really hot and close in there."
"Hot and close, I make no doubt. But it was the most gratifying dissection I have ever performed," said Van Buren, letting himself down on the bench with a groan. "My hands and back are quite stiff, and tomorrow's patients may buy themselves dried salamanders in the bazaar. I shall not attend to them. But heavens, how infinitely worthwhile. Do you know, I could scarcely overcome a feeling of extreme bitterness when I missed your Pondicherry clerk. On his mother's side, he was a Hindu, and in common piety, his co-religionists here, there are a score or so, felt themselves obliged to cremate him. And there, thought I, seeing the smoke ascend, was my very last chance of an at least partly European spleen. Lord, how little one knows. They sat in silence for a while, listening to the geckos chuckling on the wall behind them. And then Van Buren went on, "Tell me again about your rhinoceros. Had you not suspected their presence at all? No deep, well-worn paths, no droppings, no tracks?" "I had not. All these things were there, and they were apparent to me as I went back to the monastery, having seen the animals. But from some imbecility of mind, some lasting state of astonishment at the possibility of accosting a wild boar and scratching its back, and of walking hand in hand with an orangutan, I'd seen nothing. In the very first place, I didn't like to mention rhinoceroses to the monks because of the alleged aphrodisiac virtues of the horn. I didn't wish to arouse the least hint of suspicion, so they weren't in my mind at all. In any case, I've never thought of them as dwelling in mountains. The Sultan attributes Hafsa's pregnancy solely to his use of the horn," observed Van Buren. "But how very deeply concerned you must have been when they ran down the hill at you. I believe they weigh 3 tons. "I'm sure they do. The earth trembled. I trembled with it. I had some fragmentary notion of leaping like a Cretan bull, Walter. But before I could determine which foot, which hand would have been proper in Knossos, they were past me, thanks be to God. There was no malice in them, the creatures, nor in any other living thing I saw at Cumae, except possibly for some tree shrews, which I heard quarrelling among themselves." They talked in a somewhat disconnected way about tree shrews, the monk's imperfect melee, and how it increased Stephen's fluency and assurance, the anatomy of cheerfulness, what it is, plausibly said to have its seat in the spleen, perhaps in that curious set of minute granular bodies between the hilum and the gastric impression. Only disordered spleens could have given the gland its indifferent reputation. Spleens, perhaps more frequently disordered in England than elsewhere because of the climate, because of the diet, thoughts on the distribution of barn owls. And after a yawning pause, Van Buren said, "We shall have to boil Cuvier's bones after all," in an artificially casual tone that wouldn't have deceived a child. Stephen knew that it was his duty to be amazed. And in spite of an almost insuperable weariness, he cried, "How? What are you saying?" "I thought that would amaze you," said Van Buren. "We shall have to boil them, because there'll be no time for the ants to finish the cleaning. Your treaty is being written out fair at this moment in gold letters upon crimson paper, 4 full sheets of it. Mr. Fox, sworn shortly after sunrise, will attend for the signature in the early afternoon."
"Is a man to have no sleep at all, no sleep whatsoever in this vile, misshapen hulk?" cried Dr. Maturin, striking at the hand that jerked his cot and pulling the clothes over his head. Ahmed hadn't dared persist, but Bomden was made of sterner stuff, and the jerking continued, together with the words, "Captain's orders, if you please, sir. Now you're on at rouse and bit. Captain's orders, if you please, sir," which had been mingling with his dreams since the beginning of conscious time. At last he could bear it no longer. Anger dispelled sleep, and he sat up. Bondon handed him out of the cot with the most provoking mild solicitude, calling through the door, "Light it along, Killick." Ahmed appeared with a dressing gown. Between them, they conveyed him to the dining cabin, where Killick had laid out breakfast. A letter leant against the coffee pot, and Bondon gave it to him. "To be read directly, miniature, if you please," he said. "Ahmed, pour away." Maturin was fully wise in his generation when fully awake, but not so wise at present that he didn't look earnestly at the back of the letter while he sipped his first reviving cup. "It was brought by Mr. Edwards, sir," said Bondon. Killick, peering through the open door, said, "Which is there in the hold with the captain and chips this mortal minute, Your Honour?" And just overhead there broke out a shattering cry of, "Bargeman, do you hear there? Shave and clean shirt for 6 bells!" Followed by another set of orders, and a sharp cutting pipe, as the copper-bottomed launch, the honorary barge, was lowered down. He broke the seal. "My dear Maturin, I give you joy. We have won. The vizier has just sent me word that the treaty, in the exact terms we agreed upon, is ready, and I am to attend for signature at 1 o'clock, which the court astrologer declares a propitious hour. A propitious hour for us. I am only to take a small escort and suite because of the circumstances, but I trust you will be of the number. And I trust you will also do me the honour of dining here afterwards in great haste. Your most obedient, humble servant." "Humble now, I very much doubt," said Stephen. And then, looking up, "Good morning to you, gentlemen. You are both in a sad state of filth, I find. Jack, have you breakfasted? Mr. Edwards, will I pour you a cup of coffee?" "I'm perfectly willing to breakfast again," said Jack. "We've been creeping about in the hold. We've been rousing out the Sultan's subsidy," said Edwards, joy radiating from him. "You've heard the news, of course, sir." "You were so kind as to bring it yourself," said Stephen, nodding at the letter. "So I did," said Edwards, laughing happily. "I'm growing as forgetful as an old mole or a bat." At 5 bells, Jack stood up. "Come, Mr. Edwards," he said. "You and I and the doctor must scrub ourselves from clue to earring and put on our birthday suits. Killick! Killick there! You and Ahmed will help the doctor to get ready to go to court. He'll wear his scarlet robe." It was in his scarlet robe, therefore, that Dr. Maturin stood on the quarterdeck, as ready as severe shaving, a newly curled, newly powdered wig, and a good many other firm measures could make him. But in spite of them all, and the more savage kind of nursery governess was nothing to preserved Killick, his spirits rose with those of the ship. There was merriment all round him, laughter as the little heavy chests of treasure were lowered down one by one into the launch, lying under the larboard main chains, much the same general happiness as if the Diane had captured a prize, and a rich one at that. The bargemen were already eating their dinner under the forecastle awning, holding it well away from their fine clothes. Just before 8 bells in the forenoon watch, the last chest was stowed. The select guard of the marines and their officer were all in place, together with Richardson, Elliot, Maturin and young Seymour. Jack appeared in full uniform, wearing his gold-hilted presentation sword, glanced fore and aft, and came down the side, but with no ceremony. And it was with little ceremony that he met Fox's people, who had come to the landing place with a couple of shabby bullock carts for the subsidy. Not much more attended the appearance of the envoy himself, riding a handsome little Javanese horse sent by the vizier. He called out, "Good morning, gentlemen," dismounted, gave the reins to the attendant grooms, and in a low, confidential tone, he said, "Forgive me, Aubrey, I'm several minutes late. The line is already formed, I see. But should this go as I hope and trust it will, would you have any objection to sailing at once? The news should reach the ministry at the earliest possible moment, and injure, of course. I could ask the vizier to transport our impedimentar in that same double proa. While one part of Jack's mind was recording the impression of intense, barely contained excitement, not unlike a certain form of drunkenness, another ran over the state of the Diane's water, wood and stores. It can be done, he said. We may go a little short of fuel for the galley, but we can manage the evening tide. I hoped you'd say that, Aubrey, said Fox, shaking his hand. I'm so much obliged to you. I, for one, should be happy to eat my sea pie raw to gain a day, he added with a high-pitched laugh as he got onto his horse again and took the head of the procession. It was a comparatively muted ceremony at the palace, too. The Sultan was already on his throne when the mission entered the audience hall, and although he greeted them with smiles and a proper complacence, his face was ravaged, and during the long reading of the treaty it relapsed into an expression of very deep, settled unhappiness. After two speeches and the sealing and signing of both copies, he retired, and the atmosphere became much less grave. The vizier was in the highest spirits. He'd formed a valuable, potentially an extremely valuable alliance. He'd filled the treasury. He'd got rid of a most troublesome favourite. He had ensured the Sultana's goodwill. And it wasn't surprising that the presents given in the Sultan's name should reflect his chief minister's satisfaction. Fox had a coral-handled kris of great antiquity, and a jade Buddha at least twice as old. Jack, a star ruby in a lacquer box, the fruit of some distant piracy. And Stephen, a gift that for a moment put him out of countenance. A chest of the Honourable East India Company's best Bengal opium. As far as the baggage and servants were concerned, the old gentleman was delighted to be of service. Wanda would attend to it immediately. And after fond farewells, the envoy and his suite had the honours of drums and trumpets in each successive courtyard as they left, marching through a good-natured, cheerful crowd to Fox's house to dine. The dinner consisted almost entirely of fish. Many sorts of fish, all fresh, all remarkably good, accompanied by rice and lukewarm bottled ale. But it might have been boiled beef or bread-and-butter pudding for all the notice Fox and his companions took of it. Like their chief, the old buggers were beside themselves with flow of spirits and elation. But unlike him, they were extremely noisy and loquacious. At the palace, their long training had kept them silent, but now they let themselves go. This was the sort of victory they thoroughly understood, and they celebrated it in their own way with a flood of words, words that grew louder and louder as the meal progressed, voices often talking together. An odd, unbuttoned meal, even in its material aspects, with servants taking things away to pack them, waiting in working clothes, disappearing themselves, leaving the room strangely bare, rather as if they'd been bailiff's men. "Let's have no ceremony, gentlemen," Fox had said on walking into the dining-room, and they'd sat down as they pleased. The officials were clustered round Fox at the head of the table, the sailors at the foot, with Jack and Stephen at the far end. Four aside, Fox at the head, Welby rather lost at the bottom. No ceremony. The civilians took off their coats, loosened their cravats and breeches. They talked openly about the events of the last few days, and Loder was particularly eloquent on the subject of the subtlety of their campaign, the way the information had been conveyed to Hafsa, the success after several failures. Their talk became freer still, with a crossfire of wit about sodomy. Both Jack and Stephen glanced at Fox as the noise increased, but he merely looked down at his colleagues on either side with an amused condescension. It was only when Johnston cried, "And all the French are buggered too," that he said, "That'll do, Judge," in an authoritative tone, unheard before. Since discretion had flown out of the window, Stephen thought that he too would leave. It was deeply painful to hear all the fundamental rules of intelligence, all the rules of even common good sense, disregarded. And the details of this particular intelligence coup, as it might be called, were more painful still. In any case, he was determined to take a proper leave of the Van Buren's and his Chinese friends, whether the ship sailed that day or not. There was no urgency whatsoever about the treaty. The situation had already been dealt with entirely. While he was waiting for the roar of laughter that would cover his retreat, he listened to the officials' conversation. Their flattery had now become so gross that he wondered how a man of Fox's undoubted parts could swallow it. But the envoy smiled on, only shaking his head gently from time to time. The expected flash came. Peppering for adultery in England would lead to a run on the commodity. A fortune might be made by cornering the market, followed by the expected roar. And with a nod to Jack, he slipped out. He passed Loder pissing on the veranda, gave his scarlet robe to one of the marines on guard, and walked off. "But I am glad, right glad," he said, "that Jack knows just how the poor brutes were betrayed, and by whom." He walked rapidly on, passing a herd of buffaloes, and then he said, "Such mediocrity at such a level. A judge. Members of the Legislative Council. They ordered these things better in France." But honesty made him pause, and he went on, "They would order these things better in an independent Ireland, however." Jack was obliged to stay, though he didn't much care for his company, nor for the note in Fox's voice when he called down the table, "Tell me, Aubrey, just when does the tide turn this afternoon? I wish there'd be no time lost getting this document home, no time lost or dawdled away." The matter was offensive, the manner more so. And both Richardson and Elliot looked extremely nervous. Captain Aubrey was not the most long-suffering of men. Yet the feast was winding to its end at last, with many a hoot and jibe about the penniless Frenchman's plight. "Though now I come to think of it," said Crabbe, "since Duplessis doesn't have to produce his subsidy, he may be able to pay his way home." "If you have no remark more intelligent than that, Crabbe, you'd better keep your mouth shut," said Fox. "Going home in disgrace is far worse than starving here." "His Excellency is quite right," said Johnston. "Far worse." "Beg pardon," said Crabbe, sinking his face into his beer. A truly glorious dessert of fruit on three battered tin trays covered this awkward moment. And then at last came the decanters, those fingerposts towards an eventual release. They drank the king with a certain return of gravity. And then Fox, taking the silk-bound treaty from Ahmed's reverential hands, said, "I drink to the fruit of our joint efforts. I drink to what I have signed in His Majesty's name."
"Huzzay! Hear him! Hear him!" cried the suite.
The confusion of voices in which the sailors joined with a decent zeal.
"What I drink to," cried Loder, standing up and leering at Fox, "is to the bath. The most honourable order of the bath."
"Huzzay! Huzzay! Hear him! Bottoms up!" cried the others.
And while Fox looked down in smiling modesty, they drank the sentiment. They huzzayed their way on to knighthood with 3x3, and after that they drank baronetcy, a governorship, and 5,000 a year on the civil list. Jack looked at Elliot, saw that he was pallid drunk, caught Richardson's eye instead, rose and said, "You'll excuse us now, Excellency. We must go and prepare your way. Mr. Richardson will accompany you to the barge in 45 minutes. Mr. Welby, the new pinnace will come for you and your men in 30 minutes. He took the bewildered Elliot by the arm and guided him out. Seymour, at the landing place, reported the departure of the big proa and some smaller boats full of servants. Jack told him what to expect, suggested that Bondon should spread sailcloth over the stern sheet cushions, and walked Elliot off round the crater rim, hailing the ship from his usual point. "Mr. Fielding," he said, looking into the crowded waist, "are all the mission servants aboard?" "All aboard, sir, and the last baggage boat will shove off in a minute or so." "I'm delighted to hear it. The new pinnace for the Marines right away, if you please. Then I believe we may unmoor and ride at single anchor. Indeed, creep to a kedge with such quiet water and so little breeze. The envoy and his people should leave the hard in half an hour. Salute, of course, and everything man-of-war fashion. Pray let me know when they put off. I hope to sail with the first of the ebb. I trust to God the doctor hasn't wandered off looking for centipedes," he added in a lower voice, going below. He took off his coat and lay on his cot. Killick peered at him through a crack in the door and shook his head sympathetically. The Diane was unmooring, and her captain listened to the familiar sequence, the click of the capstan pawls, the cries of "light along the messenger there," "heave and in sight," and the rest. But his mind was elsewhere. In most men, in perhaps all he'd ever known, victory made them benign, expansive, affable, generous. Fox had been arrogant and hostile. He had also betrayed a meanness that must always have been subjacent, since its appearance caused no surprise. There had been and there would be no feast for the young gentlemen, the warrant officers, the foremast hands, no drinks, no address telling the good news and acknowledging their part in the successful voyage. To be sure, it wasn't a very pretty victory. It scarcely called for the ringing of church bells and bonfires in the street. He regretted his ale. He regretted his port still more. Yet even so, he dropped off for some minutes, and when Reed came with "Mr. Fielding, his compliments and duty, sir, and the barge is put off," he says, "the breeze and high water are all you could wish," he felt surprisingly fresh. "Thank you, Mr. Reed," he said. "I shall be on deck in 10 minutes or so." He let himself lie in that delicious state of complete relaxation for a while, rose up, plunged his face into water, squared his neckcloth and hair, and put on his coat. Killick instantly appeared, brushed him, arranged his clubbed pigtail and its bow, spread his best epaulettes wide and even. On deck he saw that the breeze was indeed all he had wished. It was blowing right across the anchorage, and he had but to back his mizzen topsail, make a sternboard with plenty of helm, fill, pluck up the kedge. Fielding had it almost a trip, and let the breeze and the turning tide carry the ship out while it was being run up. He also saw that everything was exactly as it should be. Yards squared by the lifts and braces, sideboys in white gloves, man ropes just so, marines all present, pipe-clad and correct, officers and young gentlemen square-rigged, Mr. Crown and his mates with their silver cauls already poised, Mr. White with his poker, the glow visible in the long evening shadow of the starboard bulwark. He gauged the distance from the advancing barge, still as rowdy as a boat full of cockneys going down to Greenwich. Nearer, nearer. "Very well, Mr. White," he said. And the first gun spoke out, followed by the remaining 12. The barge hooked on, the envoy came aboard, followed by his sweet-looking squalid, frousty, crapulous, old and unclean, their coats buttoned to the wrong buttonholes, their hair astray, and at least one flap or codpiece blowing in the wind. They were received with rigid, exact formality. And abruptly sobered, they fingered their clothes. Fox looked extremely displeased. The suite glanced uneasily at one another, and they all hurried below. "Where's the doctor?" asked Jack. "He came aboard with the Marines," said Fielding, "carrying a hairy thing. He's in the gunroom, I'm afraid."
Lord, what a relief, murmured Jack. And in a strong official voice, let us proceed to sea. As he spoke, the Prabang fortress began to boom out a farewell salute. The Dian answered it. And they were still firing, gun for gun, with the smoke drifting away to leeward as she passed through the channel into the open sea. Mr. Warren, said Jack, the course will be northeast by east, half east, and that, I trust, will bring us to our rendezvous with the Surprise.